We live in a fantasy world now. Reality has been destroyed.
This is the time that we really need to pay attention.
The probabilities are overwhelmingly on gold's side.
That is the best environment to see gold increase its value.
Welcome to Palisades Gold Radio. I'm your host, Tom Bojovics. Joining me today is Axel Merk. He's the founder, CEO, and CIO of Merk Investments, where he oversees the investments of $1.2 billion worth of gold and gold-related assets. Axel, thanks for joining me today.
Great to be with you again.
So this is a little bit of a special episode of sorts, where we're trying to highlight the importance of certain types of funds and their specific purpose. So in this case, the ASA closed-end fund invests in securities of companies engaged in the mining sector, processing or exploration of gold, silver, platinum, diamond, and other precious metals. So we're going to discuss a lot of the nuances of the market and funds today as well as why it's an important funding mechanism for the junior mining industry. So tell us a little bit about the ASA fund, Axel, and what your involvement is with it, please.
Sure. And to make it clear in the beginning, we're not pitching any investment here. We haven't offered shares in many decades. This is a closed-end fund. Mm-hmm. And closed-end funds are a special niche in the investment environment where at some point, in this case in 1958, a fund was created that invests in the mining sector. And the nice thing about it is that it allows one to have a more longer-term focus because you don't have the daily liquidity that you have in ETF. The flip side of it is that these funds tend not to trade at the net asset value as an ETF or a mutual fund would, but based on market demand and often discount. So ASA, founded in 1958, the reason it was founded in South Africa, of all places, investing in the U.S. as a closed-end fund. And accessible to U.S. investors in the U.S. and mainly invested in South African mining companies back then. The reason it was founded in South Africa was that at the time, it was very difficult to invest in gold in the U.S. It was reincorporated in Bermuda in 2004. So this is a fund with a long history. We mostly have U.S. investors. When Merk Investments was given the mandate to manage this fund in 2019, we repositioned this fund from an index-hugging fund into one that invests in junior mining companies and much more junior than even GDXJ does. We help fund and institutionalize many of the small development and exploration companies. And the idea here is, and many in the audience, of course, know the junior space is quite volatile. But the idea is that as these companies make it bigger, and obviously not all of them will make it, but there's a disproportionate value gain you can take. The multiples on the ones in the index are much higher than the small companies and so forth. Obviously, the small ones may not have any earnings at all. It's a different profile. It's a space that's very difficult to access for retail investors. And particularly, we participate in many of the funding rounds, which most individual investors cannot participate in. So it's a unique vehicle that provides a unique purpose and provides unique access to the space. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, the point you made at the beginning that we're not trying to pitch this fund or anything. We're just trying to, highlight this particular situation, because as we'll find out, there are some really interesting parts to the story at this time. But actually, let's focus for a little bit on how this acts as a very important funding vehicle for the junior mining industry and what you mean by institutionalizing some of these miners.
Yeah. So first of all, a small development or exploration company, they need to raise money, and based from mostly actually from investors who've previously had success providing capital. There are a few family offices that provide money. Mutual funds are a player, but a very small one. Mutual funds have daily liquidity and got burned last decade during the protracted bear market. What happens when they have outflows, they need to sell the liquid securities and tend to hold on to the less liquid ones. These junior mining companies tend to be rather illiquid. And so they are a little gun shy to deploy capital there. And then, of course, in the ETF space, that it, that space does not allocate money to funding round. And so we, this fund is about 370 million, and we are able to participate in funding rounds that obviously that we choose to participate in and help provide capital. Mm-hmm. And when you help provide capital, in some spaces, of course, when you issue shares, the share price gets diluted, the share price would go down. It's different in this space because you're really providing the capital for the next 2 years or so, and that tends to provide a pop in the share price. And then in 2 years down the road or so, they are presumably at the next stage of the development, and they can raise money again. And when we say we help institutionalize it, is we can go to help fairly small companies. By the way, we mostly invest in management teams, very similar to the venture capital industry, right? The venture capitalist doesn't invest necessarily in the best idea, they invest in the best management team. And so we've even invested in management teams where they didn't have the asset yet, but we knew that based on their track record, they would find and then develop an asset. And so you develop and you invest in the management team. And as one participates in these deals, helps provide funding, the next time around, they're a little bigger. And when they're a little bigger, then other types of investors can join in. And so it's part of that life cycle of the mining company. And obviously, if the early funding isn't available, things will never materialize. And of course, if ASA were not around, there might be others. But as I think many of your listeners and viewers are aware, there is much less capital in this space than there used to be. And so it is, in our view, very important that ASA is doing what it's doing. Now, just to take this a step back, our mandate is to invest in the gold and precious metals mining companies. Our mandate is not to invest in the junior mining companies. The reason we have chosen to invest in the junior space is to differentiate ourselves. Because if we were acting like an ETF is a more cost-effective structure. You can invest in that asset value and so forth. So why would you want to invest in a closed-end fund? And the reason you want to do it is because we're taking advantage of part of the unique aspects on the positive side, right? That we can have long-term capital dedicated to companies. And it's a bit of a venture capital approach where we spread the money to many investments. And we believe that those will succeed will more than make up for the ones that do not. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So are you basically providing a vehicle to those that want access in some ways to, you know, investments that are almost available only to accredited investors through, you know, private placements, things like this, and, you know, making that available to the average person in a way?
In many ways, yes. The in this space, in order to participate in these fundraising routes, you need to have connections to the right brokers. You don't need to, but it's helpful to know other investors that participate. The reason why that is helpful is because if you know who else is participating, you know based on their history how they historically behave, because you want them to be around at the next funding round. Now, all of this comes with a caveat. When companies need access to financing, they are subject to the credit conditions that are around. And the reason I mention this is because when we took over the management in 2019, for the next 2.5 years or so, a market that was favorable to junior miners, this fund performed extraordinarily well. But in the environment where the Federal Reserve had a standard goal of being quote unquote higher for longer, that restricted access to funding. And as many of your viewers know, the junior miners suffered. So we are, of course, not immune from that. Mm-hmm. Last October, Fetcher Powell gave what I would dub a mission accomplished speech, where he said that he's no longer concerned about stagflation of the 70s. And while the Federal Reserve hasn't cut rate, that change in mindset provided a signal to the market and funding got easier. Not terribly easy, but easier, mm-hmm. relatively speaking. And so ever since then, the junior miners have outperformed again. And I'm not saying that every investor should always have exposure to the junior mining space, but this vehicle allows investors exposure to the junior mining space allows them to diversify. And one of the upsides of the very significant volatility that comes with the junior mining space is that you don't need much of a diversification to have an impact on your portfolio. So a small allocation to a fund like this can help to provide diversification for whatever else one might be investing in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems like an important tool when we have these times of catalyst, like, you know, as you mentioned, when these financial conditions get eased by the market, right? But how do you see, let's say, the financial conditions going forward, or the monetary environment, I think is a better way of saying it, going forward here? You know, I think that many people didn't predict that we would be able to sustain, you know, a 5.25% overnight rate for this long. So how do you see the Fed's behavior going forward from here, Axel?
So first, for full disclosure, I was somebody who said last year that I cannot see how we cannot have a recession this year. And indeed, my forecast was that the worst of the recession would be just before the election. That can still happen, I suppose. That said, the role I see myself in, and I hope that your viewers see many guests in, is it's not about whether we are right or whether we are wrong. It's about assessing the risks that are out there. And then if one assesses the risks, well, what do I do about it? Mm-hmm. And the reason why we muse about recessions or this or that is, especially in the gold mining space, if you have a soft landing, equities in the S&P type of equities tend to discount that, look through that, and tend to be okay. If you have a quote-unquote hard landing, then the traditional equities often do very poorly, and people more aggressively look for diversification. In both of these scenarios, the Federal Reserve tends to ease. Of course, in a hard landing, they tend to ease far more aggressively. Mm-hmm. And gold and gold miners tend to be very, very sensitive to that. And so part of the reason why quote-unquote gold bugs tend to be negative on the economy is because that supports the view that you want to invest in the miners, mm-hmm. right? And so I'm putting this just out there for context, right? The more negative you are on the economy, the more it might make sense to be invested in the space. Now, I would argue that in any environment, the gold miners can provide value. Over the long term, for example, since we've started investing in 2019, we have managed to do quite well in this fund. Now, obviously, there are segments in there when the fund has outperformed, indeed, done quite poorly when the Federal Reserve was aggressively hiking rates. So if you think we're in an aggressive rate hike environment in the coming months, you might want to be careful. That's not what the market is thinking. That's not what I'm thinking. So I think the question we are facing is this economy a little stronger than expected? Is inflation a little higher than expected? And as inflation is higher than expected, will the Federal Reserve also be more reluctant to cut rates? In practice, recessions are rarely ever predicted, especially not the extent of them. And so it's often some sort of surprise that comes out of left field and whatnot. This recession that we're not experiencing was probably the most forecast recession ever. And guess what? It didn't happen, right? Mm-hmm. At the same time, my view, if you're asking me for my crystal ball and take it for what it's worth, given what I said last year, I bet on the consumer, and the consumer is not doing great. It's holding up a tad better, I would have thought, but delinquency rates on credit cards have been elevated. They've been somewhat stable now. But they are more elevated. And so I tend to bet on the consumer because it's 2/3 of the economy. So I still have a negative tint here as to how this will work out. But the Federal Reserve just is cooking with salt, right? They will look at the data. And if I can go on here with my little rant here, it used to be that the Federal Reserve could look at the yield curve and judge what the market is thinking. Mm-hmm. What has changed is that because the Federal Reserve has been so engaged in manipulating the yield curve, that they can only look in the rearview mirror and looking at some data that are weeks and months old, And so they are kind of trying to fight this from behind. It's very difficult for them. And they don't know much more than or anything more than we do. And so they just have to look at the data and decide with hindsight. And they're fully aware, of course, that the policy acts with a lag. Powell has made it clear that he has an easing bias now, but it doesn't mean that he'll cut rates tomorrow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's it's such an interesting time. And I think, you know, many of these, you know, traditional indicators have lost some of their predictive value, considering how, you know, how mixed up all of these signals are at this point. And you know, as your comment at the end there, that Powell has an easing, you know, propensity now, it seems like that is probably going to be the case. And we have yet to see how that ends up playing out. Yeah. And I think that's going to be based on, you know, inflation and the data.
Yeah, if I can just add to that, there are at least two key elements, I think, that make the current data more distorted. One is that if you think about what would happen historically when the Fed hikes rates, the housing market would be the one to suffer. It used to be a huge part of the economy after 2008, became a lesser part. But on two sides of it, that impact is muffled. Everybody knows, of course, about people being quote unquote locked into the lower rates. But the other portion, which I would not underestimate, is the protection that's been given to the small banks that completely mismanaged their interest rate risk, have had way too much exposure to commercial real estate. And so the Federal Reserve's stuffing of that issue, which by the way, they're nudging the small banks to clean up their act. But imagine had the Federal Reserve allowed the small banks to fail, we would have had a far worse economy. And so they have prevented that from happening. The other side of it is, of course, and I'm sure you've talked about it, is the budget deficit, which serves as a stimulus. And so on the fiscal side, we have a significant stimulus in the pipeline. And so both of those have reduced the impact of the rate hikes and making other economic data less useful. Just keep in mind that, of course, on the commercial real estate problems have not been resolved. And on the deficit side, that will have an impact running such huge deficits, which historically, I would allege, has been beneficial to the precious metal side. Obviously, that doesn't mean they always go up in a straight line, but there are distortions here in the system that in the long run might benefit gold. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, you know, taking yesterday, we're speaking here on the morning of Tuesday, April 23rd, taking yesterday and as an example, where gold went down over $50, you know, it you can definitely see that it doesn't go up in a straight line. But, you know, considering this environment, it seems like an important bet and an important diversifier at this time.
Keep in mind that the price of gold has gone up, even though real interest rates based on longer term measures have gone up. And I mentioned that, I'm sure many of the audience always roll their eyes when I mention long-term real interest rates, because who the hell knows what real interest rates are in the long run? I 100% agree that we have no idea what they will be in the long run. But market perceptions and changes in perception matters. We can measure what the market says based on TIPS, the inflation protected securities, what the market says real interest rates will be. Doesn't matter whether you believe in a CPI or not, that provides kind of a reference point. And as that reference point is changing, it does have a market impact. And in recent months, the price of gold has somewhat decoupled from that. Now, one can think about why that may have happened. The geopolitical context is likely a key element of that. Foreign central bank buying, of course, is another one. And of course, the price of gold came down just as there appeared to have been a lack of further escalation, let me phrase it that way, in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And so when the price of gold moves ahead of some of these indicators for an extended period, we can see significant corrections. And it's a good reminder that the volatility in this space can be quite severe.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I you know, I've had a couple of recent discussions on, let's say, how a geopolitical event like the chaos in the Middle East affects the price of gold. And, you know, it seems that a good amount of of the guests that I have spoken to about it all seem to agree that it's not necessarily a short-term driver, but not necessarily a sustained driver for the gold price.
Yeah, historically, I would have been firmly in that camp. I've become a tad more nuanced in that view, notably because I believe that the relative peace we've had since World War II has come to an end, mm-hmm. and the Middle East and Ukraine are but symptoms of a world that we're entering. And so I happen to think we'll have less stability in the world going forward. And net, that will give a support to the price of gold. Now, obviously, I can't say exactly how many dollars per ounce that will be, but that's part of the reason why the price of gold has been doing quite well, I believe. Mm-hmm.
So getting back to the ASA fund, Axel, explain the difference between a closed-end fund versus an open-end fund, and let's say the advantages of each.
So in an open-end fund, which an ETF is, or a mutual fund, you decide to make an investment and buy it in your brokerage account with a click of a button, a mutual fund at the end of the day, ETF intraday. Key difference is you buy those at net asset value. And then for the funds themselves, they have to adhere to liquidity requirements. And that significantly influences what they are ultimately investing in. And in practice, what that means, I say in practice because there are ways one can work around some of these. In practice, what that means, they tend to invest in the largest companies that are out there down to a certain level. Mm-hmm. Whereas in a closed-end fund, you buy and sell based on a market price, which is based purely on supply and demand. And historically, that's often, not necessarily, but typically at a discount and at times at a significant discount. So ASA in recent years has on average traded just under 15% discount. Many closed-end funds trade at less of a discount, but there is no other closed-end mining fund. Those are fixed income products. And so it's in our view, when you have a much less volatile space, it's only natural that the discount is much less. Indeed, the discount that ASA has come down a little bit over recent years and traded within a reasonably narrow range. But yes, it does vary. Importantly, I think there are very few, if any, investors left from 1958. Just about anybody has bought it at a discount, might one day sell it at a discount. As far as the investments are concerned, we have much more flexibility. Now, I touched on South Africa and Bermuda a little bit. Part of that reason that's relevant is because by being a foreign investment fund, we are what's called a passive foreign investment company. Those in the mining space might actually know what that means. It's a tax treatment that's somewhat disadvantageous. Mining companies often have that, that if you make more money with your investments and are corporate abroad, that the IRS gives you a little bit of a penalty. And you may have seen, or some of you may have seen, that GDXJ sometimes has very high dividend payouts. It's not that these junior companies that GDXJ is holding are paying dividends, but by paying, they basically pay out the capital gain as a dividend in order to make it easier for investors to comply with the tax treatment of these companies that are themselves considered foreign investment companies. So I probably lost half the audience now with that explainer, but ASA itself is what's called a passive foreign investment company. And that means there are certain tax considerations to be followed. The short of it is, if you own it, it's easier to own it in your retirement account. Otherwise, don't worry about it. I mentioned in this context, though, is because we create, in some ways, not the best sort of income, we also don't have to comply with some of the rules in order to able to qualify for the better income, which means if we wanted to, we could take more concentrated positions than you could do in an open-end product. So there are some unique facets, and I confused too many people here, then I apologize. The short of it is, though, that there are some unique facets that come with ASA that we mostly worry about as a manager. Mm-hmm. We do like to manage this as if it were a broadly diversified product, but we're not required to. So there are certain things we could do a little bit differently in a closed-end structure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's interesting to actually, when I was doing research for today's chat, to see how diversified you guys are within the mining space. But as you say, I think a good way to summarize it is it allows you, that structure allows you to really make a lot of strategic investments the way that you see fit, rather than having to abide by regulatory rules, right?
Well, we have lots of regulatory rules, but we don't have the liquidity rule. Indeed, we can invest in private companies. We do have some private holdings. One of the things we do when we participate in these funding rounds, we tend to have warrant issued to us as well. Mm-hmm. And in our view, warrants are helpful to both the investor and the management. Should a warrant come into the money, we can exercise those warrants. And as an investor, we make money, but it also provides more capital to the mining company. And so they tend to be beneficial to both. Some investors that come in late don't like it because of the potential dilution, but these junior mining companies, they need funding. And if they don't have the funding, they will dilute you. And so the getting diluted through the warrants is one of the better ways, in our view, for mining companies to raise money. Mm-hmm.
So explain to us a little bit about the situation that you're now facing at this point.
Yes. So part of the reason we jumped on this call here is because we have what's called a contested proxy with a shareholder meeting on the 26th of April. So just in a few days from when we're talking. Basically, closed-end funds are subject to activists sometimes coming in. And what they try to do is they try to have a short-term gain, in our view, at the expense of other shareholders, to quote-unquote close the discount. And so I mentioned ASA may trade at a 15% discount. So in theory, you could say, oh, why don't you close that to NAV? And it's actually, when you go from 100 to 85 back to 100, that is actually more than a 15% gain. And isn't that fantastic? In theory, maybe. In practice, not so fast. First of all, Saba Capital Management, that's the activist investor, last year they ran 64 campaigns. None of them, of course, in the gold mining space. They're not familiar with the gold mining space, certainly not with the junior space. And when they have succeeded, then they have closed the discount, not entirely, but only very, very briefly, and then it blew right back out. So unless you sell your shares, it doesn't work. Of course, then the fund, and they do that through a tender offer. So you basically shrink the fund, which also means that the expenses, the fixed costs, tend to be spread across a low asset base. The more fundamental, and the question is ASA still sustainable? And these would typically be about a third of the assets, right? Is that it's a 370 million fund or so in a market that's somewhat favorable. The last time this happened in ASA, the fund was 850 million. About a third of the assets were tendered. And then there was a protracted bear market. Assets shrank down to 175 million. We came in at around 200 million, just under 200 million, and have grown the fund back to about 370 million. But if you did this again, there's a serious question about long-term sustainability. Mm-hmm. But there are some other bigger issues here. One of them is, if you tell the market you're going to sell your stocks in a tender offer, other market participants are likely to front run this in an illiquid space. And we have seen that Fidelity had a fund manager change last year, for example, and the new fund manager repositioned that portfolio. Some of the less liquid names were under significant pressure for an extended period. It's not that we can't sell any of our less liquid holdings, but we like to do it when we don't report it. So we can do this very quietly, whereas in what's happening in ASA is very public. And so the public would know what we will do. And that means these junior mining companies would presumably get a significant hit if that were to happen. And so you cannot capture that discount so easily. The other way you can capture the discount, one other way is to liquidate the fund. We actually think that is the most likely scenario because they will look at other options and they will see that none of them really make sense in ASA's case. But you have the same issue, that the front-running sort of issue. And we happen to think that most investors like ASA to survive. One other thing that historically is proposed to quote-unquote close the discount is to open-end the fund, meaning to convert it from a closed-end fund to an open-end fund. We don't think that is possible based on the Bermuda status. To do it, it would cost a fortune. And by the way, anything that's unusual in any registered product, that's ETF, open-end fund, closed-end fund, tends to be very expensive. And adding the Bermuda status to with ASA only amplifies this. And so researching these things would also be very expensive. Shareholders would have to pay for that. And so all of these are very, very difficult things one can do. There are some other things we can do. The most effective thing I think one can do is to get new investors involved. And indeed, while we're not issuing shares, because it's based on supply and demand, by spreading the word about ASA, that may help increase demand and that may reduce the discount. So to me, that is one of the most shareholder-friendly ways one can do it. What we are concerned about is that if Saba were to gain control of this product, that they are fixed income managers. Increasingly, they've been taking over the management of the products they manage, and they state that in their proxy statement that they might do that. It's not their primary intended goal. We don't think investors would want this to become a fixed income product. There are more cost-efficient structures to run a fixed income product. And so, again, we think that liquidation would be the end game if Saba were to gain control. Mm-hmm.
So how is Saba trying to, let's say, force these changes? And what percentage of the fund do they have to own to be able to do this?
Yes. So Saba started buying shares in ASA late in 2022. They first showed up in filings in 2023. We reached out to them very soon thereafter to engage them in a dialogue. We tried to talk to all our shareholders, including retail shareholders, by the way. So if you want to talk to us and you are a shareholder, please feel free to reach out anytime. We finally were able to arrange a meeting in the summer, at which time we were told they're following the investment process. In October, we talked again and they again said they're just following the process. In December, they said that we don't do what's in the shareholders' interest. The board needs to be replaced. So there they became aggressive without ever having voiced what exactly they would want to do. So they never engaged in a proper dialogue. At that stage, they had about 16% of assets in the fund. And then they start what's called a proxy, contested proxy, where they try to convince shareholders that their nominees are the better ones than the current nominees. One of the challenges in the space is that the activist has many advantages. They will obviously vote their 16%. At the other end of the spectrum, many retail investors are not engaged. I'm just asking anyone in the audience, right? How often do you read the solicitation material you get in the mail that says, vote now, do this or that? You throw the stuff away. Mm-hmm. Worse so, investment advisors that invest in behalf of their clients, because the rules of the SEC are cumbersome, many investment advisors are not voting their client shares. So they leave it up to the clients. Now, if you have your money managed by an investment advisor, you outsource that to them, right? I wonder how engaged are you in the companies that your advisor engages in, and will you vote those shares? Well, maybe if the advisor nudges the client to do that, but some advisors don't even do that. They have a policy that they don't touch that. Mm-hmm. And that may work for normal things, but in a contested proxy, it means that, and what we hear from some of these advisors is that, yes, we like what you do. We love what you do. But no, we don't vote the client shares. And so it's a system that is, it is very much biased in favor of the activist. Our goal is, of course, to be able to reach as many shareholders as possible. And importantly, it's not good enough to win. We need to send a strong message because Saba has deep resources. And just because we win doesn't mean they walk away. Mm-hmm. We need to show them that our investors really like what we do. And that might entice them to walk away. There are some other things that we might be able to do over time. But it is very important. If anybody here is an ASA shareholder, please vote. And then you have to vote the quote-unquote white card. What happens in these instances is that both the activist and management sends their own proxy. Whichever one you vote last counts, and it nullifies the other vote. So we've had it happen that a friendly investor, we noticed that they voted against us. And so we talked to them and they says, what do you mean? Well, they clicked on something in an email and were kind of led to click on the wrong ballot. And of course, they then changed the vote. So if you have voted, please double check and double check that you have voted. And this has happened to very experienced investors. This is not your 80-year-old grandpa who doesn't quite know anymore what they're doing. This happens to people who are very sophisticated in the market. And it's a process that, let's just say, has substantial potential for improvement. Ultimately, it's a process not intended to help the retail investor. And the reason I say all of this is, right, we started out with that in the beginning. We care about it, of course. We're the manager of ASA. We're passionate about this space. But if Saba were to gain control, it's bad for the mining space more broadly. Now, obviously, our mandate is not to make sure that there's funding available for these companies. Our mandate is to make money for investors for investing in the precious metal space. But for all the reasons that I mentioned, I think that this strategy is one that's very valuable to our investors and also happens to help the space, right? And so that means anybody who's not invested can help spread the word. Obviously, now we are very tight before the deadline, but clearly any vote in favor will matter and will count. So it's not the November election that's the most important one. It's the one that happens this Friday, if you listen to it right after this release.
Absolutely. It's, you know, I think from both sides, it's kind of an interesting situation, right? On one hand, you have investors that, you know, see the value in this particular instrument, and that is exactly what they're invested in for that purpose. And then on the other hand, you have a capital management team that comes in, sees this discount to NAV, sees a way to try to close that discount to realize that gain, and, you know, in some ways don't really care what it wrecks along the way. And if this is an important funding mechanism for the junior mine industry that is already starved of capital, this is, you know, could have very detrimental effects.
Yeah, except, of course, we have talked to other activists, right? They're not the only activists out there. They're the biggest one. Mm-hmm. And we have talked to other activists, and they have rolled their eyes at what Saba is doing here because of the unique features. I've touched on some of those, and I apologize again for having lost some of your audience for going a little bit too much into detail. One of them, there are several of these unique features that ASA has that just makes it very impractical and not in the interest of investors to pursue this. And so even if you have this very limited goal that you don't give a darn about what ASA does, you just want to capture a discount, it doesn't work that way that easily with ASA. And that's where having a constructive dialogue would have been so helpful. I mean, this entire deal is also very expensive. One of the best ways to create shareholder value is to keep expenses low. Mm-hmm. We as the board has managed, and we've taken on management. By the way, before we took on management, the fund was internally managed. And because the fund has shrunk so much, the fixed costs were very high. And so at least the advisory fee, that's the fee that we're getting as the advisor, is now in basis points. But of course, there are many other costs that are there as well. And so by working to keep expenses low, the long-term investor gets rewarded. Now, had Thaba engaged with us, there would have been a potential at least for a constructive dialogue of what one can do, what one cannot do, explaining things in detail. Instead, what happened is they didn't engage. They aggressively bought. We took some protective measures and now have this proxy contest. All of that costs a lot of money. We carry some of that cost, but the bulk of that cost is carried by shareholders. I'm, by the way, one of the largest individual shareholders. I've been an active insider buyer through the end of last year. And so I believe in the value here of ASA. And I, of course, just like any other shareholder, carry some of that cost. But it's one of these things where if one really had shareholder interest top of the mind, there would have been a much better way to go about some of these things and try to address what concerns are real and what aren't. Mm-hmm.
So let's say this ends up going through, Axel. What does the future for the fund look like, do you think?
Well, let's assume for a moment that the existing board gets reelected. Our goal will be to continue to be to engage the activists and find a way to address some of their concerns. And at the same time, make it very clear to them that the things they historically tried to do don't work. Now, that said, if we've always said and we continue to say it, if investors have particular concerns, they should talk to us. Investors own this company. Absolutely. Right. And Thaba, of course, with 16% also are an owner. So their concerns are real. Except, of course, if they're the only investor that says something and what they want to do is at the detriment of others, the board has to look at all of those concerns. And the board has undertaken certain steps in recent months to try to address some of these concerns. It's a dialogue that must take place. We are, by the way, very excited about the sort of things we have in our portfolio, to just put that out there, right? There are some things that we believe can be very, very helpful to the return for our investors. And so we have a plan of what we would do. Now, if we, quote unquote, lose, and I say we because I'm an interested director on the board as well, then Thaba is in control. They, of course, still have a fiduciary duty. And so we will still try to explain things to them and see what is possible. We happen to believe that liquidation is the most likely scenario. And our goal is to convince investors to kind of rally the troops and make sure that people vote their shares so that we're not going to be in that situation. Obviously, we'll have to, quote unquote, deal with it. The challenge is that once a board is in control, it is much easier to induce change. Now, we can go into the SEC and complain about certain things, but one of the things they said is they might want to change the investment mandate. Well, one of the things we've put on the mandate is to increase the threshold from changing the mandate from a simple majority of those who are voting to 60% of the shares outstanding. And it's like the two-thirds majority that the Senate has, which makes it more difficult to change the mandate, but not impossible. There may well be a reason one day, and we believe that's appropriate for a fund that historically was founded to invest in precious metals. By the way, not to invest in junior mining companies, but just in the precious metal space, right? And so it's that sort of thing what we can do now and ask shareholders to support, so that the direction of the fund will remain the same. But yes, once you have a new board in place, they can, of course, do a lot of things that we think many, especially retail shareholders, may not appreciate, including also many institutions that like to have this fund as is and investing in this fund for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Axel, we wish you luck here, you know, to be able to continue the fund the way that you know, you have had the vision to try to build. Is there anything else that you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap up?
Well, if you're an ASA shareholder and come to asaltd.com where there's information about what's happening, obviously anybody else who's interested in this fund, please also come to the site. We have a newsletter. Merckinvestments.com is our primary website. From there, you can also get to it. But yes, follow what we do, get engaged. And of course, if you're an ASA shareholder, vote the white card. If you're a shareholder anywhere else, if there is a contested proxy, take it seriously and vote, because the vote does matter. The system is not in favor of the retail investor. And if retail investors want to have a power, they need to take advantage of the power that they're given.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And of course, your available excellent Twitter follow as well, at Axel Merck. Axel, thanks so much for your time today, and all the best of luck with the proxy vote.
My pleasure.
This podcast is for general informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests on this show are not compensated for their appearance. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Do not base any investment decisions on the information contained. To view our full disclaimer, please visit our website.